nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
So let's go into the lecture and talk about the general problem of cell entry. The biggest problem that we have is that the cell is designed in many ways along two fronts. One is that the cells are not very passive. They actually will interact with their environment, and they will tend to gobble things up that are in their vicinity. That's a natural function of cells. Some cells do that a lot more than others, but every cell has some mechanism for taking things from the outside of the cell to bring them in. And that's a necessary thing for life to happen. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that cell membrane is designed to be a buffer between what's inside the cell and what's outside the cell. And so it's very important that we maintain the integrity of that cell membrane while we're treating the cells. Otherwise, if we damage that, we can injure or kill the cells in the process of uptake. So we're going to talk about a number of things relating to how things naturally happen. And of course, again, with sort of biomimetic mechanisms, things such as viruses naturally interact with cells and cell membranes and have evolved quite a number of mechanisms to be able to get from the outside of the cell to the inside and then inside to actually interact with the host cell machinery. So we'll talk a little bit about that later in the lecture. So in terms of choosing the modes of cell entry, we'd like to have this thing, this process under our control. So that means that we have to control the things that we've designed into it. We also have to control the things that are going to happen anyway, such as size, charge, other things, which then are going to have their own mechanisms. So all of these competing mechanisms for uptake and cell entry, we want to be able to, at the end of the analysis, we want to be able to get ourselves, in terms of taking up the nanomedical devices and being able to do something functional with them. It doesn't do any good to have them go inside the cell and be non-functional for one reason or another. So we're going to talk today about several ways in which, you can not only get them inside the cell, but have them escape the natural destructive mechanisms that the cell has designed to identify foreign things and break them down. So there are a number of those things. We'll, again, use a lot of biomimetric things in this process. So when we have very small particulates and molecules in the vicinity of a cell, there's a process of fusing with elements of the cell membrane called pinocytosis, and can be a very active mechanism. That's typically for very small things. As you get into larger things, and some cells can actually swallow rather large objects. For example, macrophages can phagocytose bacteria quite easily and just engulf them and take them in, and even though these things are rather large. So what we want is something that is actually closer to the pinocytosis. Our nanoparticles are typically small. If we start making, as they get larger, they tend to be more and more taken up by phagocytic mechanisms, and we definitely don't want them to be taken up by phagocytosis by various blood entities such as macrophages and monocytes and neutrophils, because those could not only decrease the amount of available nanoparticles for our cell therapy, but they could also injure those cells and indirectly target, particularly if they get taken up non-specifically. So we want to be conscious of these things. The main way that we're going to try to avoid general phagocytosis while things are circulating in the blood is by putting a stealth layer of something like polyethylene glycol or similar materials on the outside to try to prevent the deposition of proteins, which usually leads to the immune system attacking and phagocytic mechanisms being activated. The cell is also not a balloon-shaped device that has just a simple cell membrane and a simple interior It's a very complex interior that has many, many subcompartments and a lot of membranous material, a lot of channels, microchannels, as shown in this slide. And you'll see that there are mechanisms, almost channels and tunnels, to design to actually bring various molecules and other things into the cell. In general, if something comes in and is ingested that's thought to be foreign, it usually goes into something called an endosome, which then typically can have very acidic pH. It can also contain hydrogen peroxide and other things to break things down, particularly in the lysosomes. And then as it's processed through this, you can go to the Golgi apparatus and you can go to the so-called proteasome mechanism, which actually is, you want to think about it, it's kind of like a garbage disposal system inside the cell, that once things are actually broken down into more constituent, like amino acids and other things, then that's an actual mechanism for recycling within the cell. So this is the normal mechanisms that we go through. And if the nanoparticles in general end up in the early endosomes and have no escape mechanism from that, they're gonna pretty much sit there and accumulate, but not probably have a very good outcome in terms of a nanomedical device delivery and getting drugs to where they need to be. This is a two-way process. We also have things being secreted. We have receptors being taken into the cell. When we say something is receptor-mediated, we mean that when something attaches to the receptor, and is typically a ligand receptor relationship, for example, folate with folate receptors, and then the receptor takes it in internalizes it, sometimes that receptor is immediately recycled out to the outer surface so that it can process things again. Sometimes that receptor is degraded and has to be resynthesized, and that can lead to some interesting delays, in which time you'll have things at the surface are taken up, but then there may be a lag time particularly if you give a lot of drug to the surface and the receptor has to be regenerated. So you may overwhelm those receptors, take them in, and then they have to be resynthesized. So there's a lot of complexity of this, and just want to make you aware of the fact that this very complex dynamics, this is just sort of the physical dynamics of this. We also have a number of signal transduction pathways, which are designed specifically to pull certain things into the cell and to take certain things and excrete them out of the cell. So cells are very, very active things. I'm going to show you a movie here shortly that may surprise some of you, particularly with more engineering background, that are not used to seeing that cells are very, including the cells in your body, are very active things, crawling over each other and doing a lot of active mechanisms. So one of the first things I'm going to do is go through a little exercise here. This is the Chow reference, and this is a quantum dot nanoparticle uptake. And basically what they did in this study was to study the effect of surface coatings, and in particular looking at polyethylene glycol modifications of that, and found that if they had the polyethylene glycol can also have carboxyl groups. There are many forms of polyethylene glycol that can be branch chained. They can have functional groups on them or bifunctional groups, so you can attach things. But in general, if you have a carboxyl group on that, they will get internalized very quickly. And did an interesting study of this, and you'll be reading more about that in the paper. But it goes through a multi-step process here of going into the early endosomes, the late endosomes, and then into the lysosomes, where things are processed and or degraded. And it's a multi-step mechanism for processing something that comes into the cell. You'll notice that when you bring something into the cell by these mechanisms, quite often there's an invagination of the cell membrane, and that's particularly helped if you have something that fuses readily with it. And polyethylene glycol fuses very nicely with cell membranes. In fact, that's one way that people have created somatic cell hybrids, and, for example, made, as we talked earlier about making hybridomas with particular properties, with myeloma cells and natural B cells, and then fusing them together to make a hybrid cell. So that fusion process brings effectively the peg on the surface of the quantum dot into intimate contact with the lipid bilayer, and then there's a lot of lateral motion so that things can move around, and it becomes a pretty much a thermodynamically driven process. Let's actually watch the uptake in this particular one of quantum dots by, as you can see in here, you're actively taking up the red quantum dots in here. You'll see now we're getting more and more uptake in the regions. It's a little hard to see on with the amount of lights we have here. Can you see that now, or should I lower the, can I lower the lights? Let me play that one more time for you. So these cells are very, very active, and they're bringing things across the cell membrane. You see the red quantum dots are actually coming into the cell. They'll in general stay in the cytoplasm, although if the quantum dots are small enough, they will be able to come through the nuclear pores into the nuclear membrane. They're right at the border. I told you quantum dots are, particularly red ones, are on the order of about 7 or 8 nanometers across, typically, depending on the material, if we're talking about a cadmium-based quantum dot. And with the biocoatings, they're out to about 14 nanometers, and that's right about between 14 and 20 is about the range where you can actually get things transporting across the nuclear membrane through the nuclear pores. If it gets much bigger than that, then you won't be able to get it across the nuclear membrane. So it turns out that in addition to the material itself mattering, when you have nanoparticles and you make these nanoparticle structures, including just the nanoparticle cores, the size itself matters. And that's rather an interesting thing, because bigger nanoparticles can quite of the same material or agglomerated versions of smaller nanoparticles that come up to a cell membrane can actually not only have a different mechanism for getting across or not getting across the membrane, but they can also have different toxicity. In other words, a single nanoparticle may be relatively non-toxic, but when you start getting them agglomerated, they get to the outside of the cell, then that nanomaterial cluster can create a nanotoxic effect. And that's not well understood. And it probably has more to do with the fact that you're changing the ordering of molecules around the outside of the cell when you have a very high density. We won't normally see these in vivo nanomedical systems, but this happens a lot when people are doing in vitro experiments. And this is my complaint, that many people doing in vitro experiments use literally 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more nanoparticles per cell than they would ever have in an in vivo situation. And when they get to very high concentrations like that, you'll actually start getting some artificial effects of nanotoxicity just due to that much nanomaterial being around outside the cell. So that's something you should keep in mind. So let's go through. I must mention that size matters. The shape itself matters, and we'll talk about that in terms of aspect ratios, whether things are spherical or rod-shaped. Agglomeration, which can happen, and we'll be talking much more about agglomeration in the next lecture on Tuesday on zeta potential, because that does pretty well control most of what causes agglomeration. Agglomeration in general reduces uptake, so we don't want that to happen. And then I'm going to walk you through from Eric Chan's lab a nice sample study. So this particular one, we can see here, is the number of gold nanoparticles per cell versus the size of those gold nanoparticles. And it actually, this particular one, shows a peaking of that. And then it starts dropping off after you get up to about 80 nanometers. So at about 20 to 40 nanometers is a very convenient size, and the cell almost wants to take those things up by a pinocytosis process. And if you look at the uptake, again, as a function, again, following this up with transmission microscopy, then you will see by electron microscopy the particles inside various regions of the cell. And so in this particular case, you see them going into vesicles and endosomes, and they're gathering. And I showed you last time a case of quantum dots being clustered, where we had literally thousands of quantum dots coming into an endosome. That's in general what's going to happen if it goes through the normal endocytic mechanism. Now, many things never escape from that. And we're going to talk today in part of the lecture about how you can get those to actually escape from from those endosomes. Now, in terms of the aspect ratio, what we find is an interesting study, again, by Chen's group. When you have essentially a spherical particle, then you have a relatively high uptake. As you get to more rod-shaped, you get fewer actually coming into the cell, but that we're going to see later on in the course that's sort of the opposite effect that we see in terms of circulation time. Usually if we make something more rod-shaped, it will increase, all things else being equal, it will increase its circulation time. So we're going to play those things off against each other. It may or may not be a good idea to be spherical. It matters what the diameter is. If you make it rod-shaped, you may increase the circulation time and therefore get a better delivery per initial dose. But then on the other hand, you may have more trouble getting an uptake depending on what the cell type is. So here is a nice study of the effects of the aspect ratio of those different rod-shaped particles. Now, receptor-mediated uptake transport, and this is sort of the main one that we will typically use, and that is we either have a targeting molecule or we have a ligand going to its receptor. Why do we do that? We do that because the cell, in many cases, already knows how to process something that links up with that receptor. So what we try to do is have our nanoparticle take advantage of that process. And then once we've done that, the receptor has a whole series of mechanisms that it can be part of a signal transduction pathway. It basically knows how to take things across the cell membrane. And in many cases, can be part of a signal transduction process that may take it to a particular part of the cell that we want it to go to interact with other molecules. So receptor-mediated transport is a very desirable thing. We're going to talk more in the next lecture about having producing a little bit of a charge barrier with the zeta potential, so we have electrostatic repulsion unless we get very close proximity with that receptor. That ensures that things just don't stick to the cell surface. Because if that happens, then we have no targeting mechanism. Now, that's one thing when you're doing an in vitro experiment, with one cell type, in a tissue culture plate. But it's quite another when you put it in the body and you don't want those nanoparticles going to every tissue and organ and sticking non-specifically. So you want to create a little bit of a barrier, electrostatic barrier, governed by the zeta potential, and then reaching across that barrier will have the receptor, either an antibody, aptamer, peptide, or some kind of a ligand receptor, pulling it across the desired molecules. And how do we know that it's gone by that process? So what I'm going to do is take you through a little bit of a very nice paper by Nancy Montero Riviere's lab at University of North Carolina, where she's done specific uptake mechanism studies by inhibiting pathways with specific drugs. And I'll just show you a couple of examples from that. But that's the way that you actually prove that you have the particular transport mechanism pathway that you think you have. So here's a table in her article, where she's basically has a series of drugs that have specific inhibiting or disrupting functions, and you can very exquisitely use those to disrupt specific parts of a cell function, and hopefully without disrupting other parts. That's at least the principle. Doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes these things have far more general effects. But the idea is to get as specific as you can with a drug of interest and to just inhibit a very specific interaction of molecules within the cell. So what she did there was to actually look at the surface coatings and to see if they were recognized by these pathways and then disrupted those. And so the first study she had was with some quantum dots, and she again used the quantum dots. This is an in vitro experiment, but because these, as I mentioned last time, the quantum dots are very bright, visualizable, and particularly by image and confocal microscopy, so that you can actually three-dimensionally look at where they go in a cell. And for this kind of study, you really want to look three-dimensionally within cells and lawns and tissues. And so these particular ones are from a human embryonic kidney cells, and these quantum dots were coated with a carboxylic acid groups on the outside and PEG, and then incubated with the cells. And what you notice is typically is you get a what's called a punctate, meaning it's decorated around the surface, not completely randomly, but in very typically somewhat small, very small patches. If those patches start to come together, then you get something literally called patching and then potentially capping, which is typically what we don't want to do. Two things can happen when you patch and cap. One is that they can patch and cap and literally shed and go away, in which case it's lost completely from the cell. Or you can patch and cap and then you get receptor internalization. So it really depends on the particular one of interest. So in here, what she's going through is a whole series of different patterns, and then doing, and you'll notice, essentially sectioning through these and the so-called Z stacks, or when we're optically sectioning through by confocal microscopy and actually being able to follow from the outside. How do you know? If you look two-dimensionally at it with just a two-dimensional fluorescence microscopy, it's sometimes you can focus up and down and try to do that with your eye and with your brain, but it's a little hard to tell whether it's really outside or inside the cell. But once you can really optically section these, then you can look at it from multiple viewpoints, and then there's really little doubt as to whether it's inside or outside the cell. And again, we come back to ultimately the gold standard, no matter what type of nanoparticles we're using, typically is a transmission electron microscopy to actually look in thin sections, and we have to have an electron dense structure to do that. But, the one, just keeping in mind, one danger of that is that when we're, contrary to the confocal microscopy where we get the complete cell, and we can actually visualize the entire cell, when we do all of the electron microscopy, we're always doing thin sections. And so we may be going through part of the cell and we may miss the part of the volume of the cell where the nanoparticles are. So that's why people will typically look across a field of cells with electron microscopy and they'll try to effectively reconstruct what's happening three-dimensionally by looking at different cells. And that's a rather dangerous activity. You can sometimes get some very bad artifacts or miss completely where things are going. There are some new sort of next generation electron microscopy instruments, which I think are going to become very important. We don't have one yet here at Purdue. There have been a number of attempts to get one of those machines, which will effectively tilt the planes and then do a three-dimensional reconstruction. So to get with electron microscopy the kind of image at that level that you would get with confocal microscopy at the optical level. So the problem obviously, as a confocal microscopy, we're not getting to nano-level things. If we could get to electron microscopy in 3D, then we could actually section through the cells, and people have done that and published that. And that allows you to look three-dimensionally where the actual nanoparticles are and actually see individual nanoparticles. Okay, so in this particular study, what Riviere's lab is doing is proving that the quantum dot uptake is receptor recognized and involved in this particular associated pathway. And essentially what they're doing is they're inhibiting the pathway, and you can see that inhibition in this these photographs in step B. And by effectively poisoning that pathway, you can shut it off and show that if it's taken up by that particular pathway, then you can block it. If it's not taken up by that pathway, it'll proceed very nicely without, in spite of your inhibition. So it's a very handy way to actually study it, very, very particular pathways. Okay, there's two interesting papers that I came up with that I thought would be good for you to read and to think about. One of these is actually using a coating of acrylate and comparing that acrylate-coated gold nanoparticles with uncoated nanoparticles. And if you look at the overall theme in this is by Kerpetics group et al., and in this particular one recently published, you can actually look and see that if you don't have coatings on the gold nanoparticles, they essentially go into the endosomes and they stay right there. They effectively, you've put them inside the cell, they will stay in there and they will not do anything further. But with this particular acrylate coated nanoparticles, what they showed was that they go in the endosome, but the acrylate causes them to be able to come out of the endosome and go into the cytoplasm of the cell. Now, what you would need at that point, and they don't show that, of course, in this study, is that would be, and again, your multi-layered medical system, you would then have to have some kind of after you escaped, so you'd have your acrylate layer to get out of the endosome and back into the cytoplasm, and then you would want to have typically an amino acid localization sequence, which would take you to the nucleus, to the mitochondria, or whatever part of the cell that you wanted to actually bring your nano drug delivery system to. So they don't discuss that in this paper, but you could easily see from what they've done, if acrylate were on that step, what you'd then want to do is to have either the acrylate come off, or to have something which projects through the acrylate with a sequence which would then allow it to take it to do a cytoplasmic localization. But I think this is very interesting to show a very simple way how a coating can make a vast difference of what happens inside the endosome as to actually get an escape mechanism. And he goes through, and this is particular one is done with silicon mesoporous nanoparticles, which I know is of interest to some people in this room. He's using basically a function of that going into the particles and actually looking at their distribution, where they are in the cytoplasm, and when they're free and when they're actually in the endosomes. Now, I mentioned to you previously that if you have things aggregated or pre-aggregated, then they can behave very, very differently. And this particular study, he basically shows that effect, that while you have those nice properties of these particles when they're acrylate coated, when they're single, if they're aggregated, then they're not going to behave the same way. And essentially what they do is they get stuck. They go in by a totally different mechanism. They go in by pre-aggregated ones, go in by phagocytosis, which is usually what happens when particles are larger. And once they go in by the phagocytosis mechanism, they're not going to redisperse in the same way. And typically this pre-aggregation, as we'll learn in the next lecture, is caused by the zeta potential of the particles becoming unfavorable, such that they want to start clumping. And that can happen with a change in pH, which is quite common, or it can change with ionic strength, which the ionic strength of a cell varies in different parts of the cell. So because of all those subcompartments. So this is something, pre-aggregation is a very bad thing in general, and it destroys the targeting. It tends to give a lot of nonspecific uptake. And if it does get taken up by the cell, it typically is not going to go where you designed it to try to go to. So that's something we really want to avoid. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about microenvironment and external stimuli. So I gave you a nice review. Which actually looks at a lot of these different factors. Most of the things that you read in the literature for microenvironments for triggering drug release tend to be pH or temperature. But what he tries to show and describe in this article, and we will do a little bit more in this course, is that you can use things like electromagnetic radiation. You can use electric or magnetic fields to actually cause a trigger mechanism. This gives you an external trigger. Remember, if you don't have an external trigger, then you've got to design a completely autonomous nanomedical system, meaning you put it in and it's got to find its way through multiple environments. It's got to adapt. It's got effectively got to be smart to adapt to its local environment so that it doesn't, for example, as in the previous one, doesn't agglomerate. If it gets into the wrong environment, all of a sudden you could cause a clot in the bloodstream in the heart. That would be a very bad thing, or in the brain. So we need to be able to keep things monodispersed. We also need to be able to activate, in some cases, use these external stimuli or microenvironment stimuli like pH and temperature to actually cause a release. When we think about our multi-layered nanoparticle concept, we quite often have to get rid of a layer in order to expose the next layer so that we can do the next thing and have a programmable nanoparticle. And as part of that, then, pH has been used a lot, particularly for endosome escape. So you design a particle that goes into the endosome, but the endosome, that it goes into has a very low pH, acidic pH, and then it breaks down the outer coating and then releases a particle which then wants to fuse with the endosome vesicle wall and then go back out into the cytoplasm, for example. So there's a lot of external ones here. We can also use electric fields to help and magnetic fields to help improve the local concentration of things. We can get a number of effects. We essentially have stimuli and various responses that we can see from that process. So these are multiple ways in which we can effectively put a switch on our nanoparticles so that it does not have to be an autonomous mechanism. That gives you external control, so you can turn this on and off, and if it goes to the wrong place, you can then decide not to activate it there. For example, if you had a magnetic one, you would increase the concentration locally, but if it went elsewhere, you might not also activate it with a magnetic field. For example, we could have a external magnetic field that we can put an alternating current variation on that. And if we do that, we can actually generate heat. So that's one way that we can actually, in the absence even of a drug therapy, we can actually do hypothermia therapy in cell regions. We could also use the magnetic field and the heat to effectively dissociate a layer. And that's particularly true if you make something that is held together by hybridization. which is going to be thermally sensitive. And if you do that right, we've done some earlier work where we actually showed that if you can get about differences of maybe 3 degrees centigrade temperatures, you can actually peel off layers one by one. And so that you can, but if you can control the temperature locally, you can control which layers come off and which ones don't. You can use a magnetic field to increase the concentration just by simply pulling the magnetic particles, if they're made with, for example, superparamagnetic iron oxide cores, to pull them to get a higher local concentration. Then one of two things can happen. You can either have them pull them close enough so that they have a higher concentration and then go up by receptor-mediated uptake, or you could have an iron core. Let's say you have a mesoporous structure. You could make a hybrid iron oxide and silicon mesoporous structure that would actually do a controlled drug release locally where you wanted it to go and not to where you didn't want it to go. So in addition, this is also in addition to the fact that you can use, for example, in this case, a magnetic field to actually as a MRI contrast agent field for imaging. So the structure can be quite complicated, and you can have a lot of chemistry going on here. And in particular, it might be very sensitive to temperature that you could externally control. So you effectively can turn the temperature switch on or off, and do that even in multiple layers so that you peel off the layers. So with all of this, what I'm trying to talk about today is essentially how you think about consciously trying to move from the outside of the cell, a nanoparticle, to the inside, how to control the concentration of nanoparticles right on the periphery of the cell. If traditional drug delivery is concentration-driven, all the pharmacokinetics are pretty much dependent on concentration. But when we start having a nanoparticle that we can control the local concentration of, and actually protect that drug which may be encapsulated inside the nanoparticle, then we can use much lower doses, improve the circulation time, and then try to bring a local concentration to where we need it so that we can actually deliver the maximum therapy for the lowest possible dose. And I've indicated to you previously, and I think it's a fair estimate, that if you do that properly, you should be able to decrease the dose by about a factor of 10 and get the same effective drug therapy at the targeted site. So that should be a rough goal of your work. And if you can get that factor of 10, then a lot of the side effects that we talked about at the beginning of the course and the reason why we do nanomedicine, a lot of those side effects will go away. And we'll be able to use drugs, which are perfectly good drugs if we could just use 10 times less drug per patient, and also target it so that only what gets inside a cell is what we want to get inside the cell. So that drug is pretty much either stays inside the particle until it's taken up inside the cell, internalized, or until the nanoparticles are localized in the vicinity of the targeted tissue, and then may elute a free drug at that point, but then not expose that free drug elsewhere in the body. So either of those approaches can be important ones for you to think about. So with all of that, next time I'm going to talk about those initial interactions, but in the meantime, I want you to do at least a fast read of all of these papers. And I think in some of these, this particular review is a particularly good one. And I also want you to look in detail at the one by Montero Riviere's group, because it tells you how to dissect your way through receptor-mediated uptake, which I think is an important thing if you really want to understand what your particle is doing versus what you thought it might be doing. Because you've got all these other mechanisms that you've got to watch out for that are also happening. And you've got to walk your way through all of that complexity to see what you, and ultimately, whatever mechanism you have has to be more dominant than all of those non-specific mechanisms. Otherwise, your system is simply just not going to prepare what you thought it was going to do. Okay. Do you have any questions? I'm through a little early today, but I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Yes.
So in the slide 8, there was a description about the uptake of the nanoparticles in the cells.
Okay, let me go back to 8. Okay, yes.
Is this like, what kind of cell is it? Is the size like dependent on the kind of cell, or is it a generic thing?
Okay. So the question is the size distribution of gold nanoparticle uptake is a function of its diameter. Is it a function of the cell type? And the answer is yes. And I think what they're doing is they're taking a particular cell type that's not particularly hugely sensitive to being, and it's not like a phagocytic cell. I believe this was a HeLa cell. So it's just a pretty average cell in terms of what would be uptaking. And then what they're doing is just showing that there is a size dependence. But every cell type would have a slightly different one. And if you had something that was, for example, a very phagocytic type cell, then the bigger ones would actually, because it would come by a different mechanism, the bigger ones would actually probably get taken in even faster. Because its function, some of the cells of the body are literally designed to look for big foreign particulates and to gobble them up specifically. And so that curve would look vastly different then. It might have some at lower end here, but it would start picking this up very fast as the particles got bigger. So it's going to depend on cell type. But I think for most normal cell types, like epithelial cells, myocardial cells, those kinds of cells are probably going to have something at least roughly like this, that there will be some optimal point of uptake, and then it'll decrease on either side of that. But it will be very much dependent on cell type. Good question.
Yeah. On the this kind of temperature. By applying some magnetic field, you can change the temperature.
Yes.
Right. So is there, that can lead to some kind of getting rid of these layers for the next step.
Mm-hmm.
Is there also a way of temperature-dependent apoptosis of the cell?
Okay. So his question concerns using, for example, an alternating magnetic field to generate heat. And there's two things. The first thing he was referring to was making a temperature-dependent layering structure on the nanoparticles. One of the easiest ways to do that is actually to do a DNA oligomer-type linkages, which then have a DNA melting temperature, and you can actually design the oligomers to melt at a temperature that you're likely to be able to reach. And your second question was, the second part of that was, whether the temperature itself would induce apoptosis. And the answer to that is it varies obviously by cell type, but normally the cells in your body are designed to run very efficiently at about 37 degrees centigrade. When you get to about above 42 degrees, typically 42, 43, 44, degrees, then you start having a temperature induced apoptosis process, and also sometimes necrosis. You got to be a little careful with that. Temperature killing is a little bit of a crude instrument. It's not as elegant as inducing apoptosis with a specific peptide down a signal transduction pathway, but a hyperthermia will occur typically. And you can easily get the body up, parts of the body up to 43, 44 degrees. You obviously don't want to get the brain up to that part. But you can quite often produce hypothermia in specific parts of the body and get cell killing that way. Good question. Yes.
So what do you think might have caused, like, as you increase your, there's an optimum size of like gold nanoparticle for uptake? Like as you, if you're going lower, it decreases. If also if you're going higher than that, it also decreases. Is that because of different mechanism of uptake, you think?
Okay, so the question concerns the differences in uptake with the size of the nanoparticles, whether it's happening due to different mechanisms or whether there's other things involved. I think at the very low end, there are mechanisms like pinocytosis that only will work up to a certain size, and then they will not go in by that mechanism. And at the high end or the large end, you have completely different mechanisms, the phagocytic ones. When you're in the middle, and we did a number of experiments testing this with quantum dots where we actually made our own quantum dots of different size and made some very large quantum dots. It turns out you can make them much, much larger and you get these sort of quantum dot domains, but it's still the material. So we're making quantum dots from all the way up to 200, 300 nanometers. And what we found was that the mechanisms, the rate of uptake was very different as we made the same nanomaterial much larger. As we watched, the uptake changed, and so did the cytotoxicity of that. And I indicated to you earlier that I thought that at some point you can make the nanomaterials themselves are not very natural things. They're not organic. They're very hydrophobic typically, unless they're really covered with hydrophilic components. So when they get to the surface of the cell, they can disturb a lot of the surface characteristics. And remember, the cell has a very delicate relationship through that cell membrane with its external environment. And as you start getting things of a particular size and a particular concentration on the outside of the membrane, then you disturb the natural traffic that goes across that membrane. There's also the curvatures. If you look at the shape uptake, it's partly a function of how the curvature of the particle, and you're typically going to have some kind of coating on the nanoparticle anyway to make it hydrophilic enough to go into solution. But the curvature of the sort of the radius of curvature of the nanoparticle, and how it interacts with the cell surface, it will thermodynamically, it'll be a little different how it actually interacts with the lipid bilayer. So I think that in general, that may be why we see some of the differences that we do between things like nanorods versus nanoparticles. With different curvatures, that the uptake is different. Because once it gets in, you watch that invagination step, and it's quite different when things have a very small radius of curvature. So if you want to think of it, if you have a high aspect ratio nanorod, it's kind of like having, depending on which side of it interacts with the cell, one side can be very flat, like a very large radius of curvature, and the other can be a rather small. So it acts like, you know, almost like it's more than one type of particle in terms of maybe activating mechanisms and how it can fuse with the cell membrane. So that's a complicated question. I don't think that's well understood, but what I was trying to show you was at least that there are measurable effects based on shape alone. Yes?
I think there's something interesting to concentrate on the nanoparticles. But for like a human body, it's like you want to focus at the tumor against the tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Is there ways to focus that to like a liver tumor or something?
Okay, so if I understand your question, you're basically saying that the ability of being able to use magnetic fields to be able to increase the local concentration of nanoparticles is a handy thing to be able to do. The question is, when you get to certain parts of the body, is it possible to design effectively a properly magnetic focusing such that you can get it to that tissue or organ? I think if you're talking about a deep organ, being able to get enough magnetic field and to shape that adequately would be quite difficult. I think that what has been shown, and I mentioned that early in the course, that there are various groups, including one in Germany, that increase the local drug concentration and effective use of the drug from its normal 1 or 2%. They were simply taking it, I think, in the arm region, and actually using a magnet where they were able to get enough magnetic field, so they were getting on the order of 40% drug delivery with that from a circulating nanoparticle system. We're trying to develop a particular application using focused magnetic fields and nanoparticles for ductal breast cancer, with the idea that that's probably not that deep, that you can't construct a three-dimensional magnetic shape and use that to actually focus nanoparticles up through from the nipple up through the ductal structures to where the actual ductal cancer starts. And the neat thing about that is you can reverse the magnetic fields and effectively pull the unbound nanoparticles out. So our strategy, we're working very actively on this, is to actually have targeted nanoparticles. If they reach their targets with ductal breast carcinoma, they will bind to those cells, and then the free ones can be effectively taken back out. And that's a nice application because, in general, people tried and failed many, many times treating ductal breast cancer, just trying to force drug up through the ductal network. So here you're leaving the fluid alone stationary, and you're simply using a magnetic field to move particles through a stationary fluid to their site, and then washing sort of the unbound ones free from that. And then you get both diagnostic and therapeutic value. The diagnostic value being that you get a very much greater, you get effectively an X-ray contrast agent for mammography so that you get a much better signal, the noise ratio. And then if you have one that's suspicious, you can actually take those same magnetic particles that are electron dense for X-rays, or also MRI contrast, T2 contrast agents, so you can actually do an immediate MRI. So that's for the diagnostic part. The neat thing about that therapeutically is that we'd like to be able to design an AC magnetic field that generates enough heat so that we could actually get up to maybe 42, 43 degrees centigrade and actually do a hyperthermic locally right where those nanoparticles were. That would be after you washed out the other ones. And that would have the nice advantage of not putting any toxic drug into the body in the first place. So you don't have to worry quite so much about residual damage, although there conceivably could be some hyperthermic residual damage. So there's a lot of advantages, but I think it's going to be very difficult to do deep tissue and organ magnetic focusing on that. I wouldn't bet on that one. But very good question. More questions? Okay.